It's good to have everyone. We've had some of our kids and grandkids here this week, and Judy and I had 12 people in our house for 5 days, and we're exhausted. They left early this morning, and anyway, it was a fun time, but it's good to be here with you tonight. We're going to be talking about miracles. By the way, I just want to reinforce the importance of reading that story before you come to class, because sometimes we'll have you discuss that story around your table. Sometimes we'll be making reference to it during the time when we're talking and everything. So it's really helpful if you've read that story. They're all true stories, and I just want to encourage you to do that. So with that, let me pray and we'll get started. Father, thank you so much for who you are again. Thank you that we can gather here freely, that we can talk about these things, that we can discuss together. God, none of us has all the answers to anything. I pray that you would help us to have a studied assurance of what we believe and why, but help us never to become cocky and think we know everything, because we don't. I pray you'd use this time tonight to encourage us and help us and challenge us in the ways that you want to. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, what I'd like you to do is take about 3 minutes, and assuming you've read that story, just talk about that story for about 3 minutes, and I'll get us going here. Around your table, what'd you think about the story? Okay. Thank you for taking a few minutes to discuss that true story about Jay and Orange. Orange, as it talks about in the story, was a seminary student who was going to seminary for some wrong reasons back in his day, but he was going to seminary. But he also was very clear about the fact that he was an atheist. He did not believe in God. And some of you may be wondering, how can you go to seminary and not believe in God? It's very easy because there are a lot of seminaries that don't believe in God. In fact, back in the 70s, the God is Dead movement got started in America in a seminary about 10 miles from where I was going to seminary at the time. Excuse me. It's not uncommon at all. In fact, I'm going to read you some things in just a second. But the interesting thing about that story is that it is a true story about Jay and Orange. Excuse me. Jay is not the man's real name. Jay is a pseudonym for the book, but he's a friend of mine. And this story took place. It happened this way. And we'll get to the end of the story in a few minutes. When we get to the end of our time today, we'll look at what happened to Jay and Orange in that conversation. But you're going to be able to have those kind of conversations with people. You're going to run into friends, family members who do not believe in miracles at all. They haven't really thought about it a whole lot, usually, but they just don't believe in miracles. Now, you'll run into some folks who have thought about it a lot, and have a lot of questions, and hopefully the time we spend in here and the handouts that I give you will be helpful in being able to answer some of those questions that people have who have thought about it even more. But usually people sort of have bought into the line of the day, what everybody else is saying, and they've heard this and they regurgitate it to you. And so we want to look at how do we respond to different people. Just once again to reiterate how realistic this is, I don't know how many of you have heard about John Shelby Spung. Have any of you read any of his works at all? He is a bishop, an Episcopal bishop. He's retired now, retired in 2001. He's still writing and doing different things. But Bishop Spung wrote a book called A New Christianity for a New World. And early on, in the very beginning of that book, he makes these claims about himself. He said, "I am a Christian." Another place he says, "I believe that God is real. He said, I call Jesus my Lord. He says, I have been deeply impacted by Jesus, his death, and the Easter experience we call the resurrection. But then he goes on and he says these things about that Easter experience, as he called it. The Christian faith was born in the experience that we have come to call Easter. It was this Easter experience that invested Jesus with a sense of ultimacy. It caused his followers to regard his teaching as worthy of being preserved. It was the reason that St. Paul could write, if Christ has not been raised, then your faith is in vain. Clearly, without Easter, there would be no Christianity. He says then that the assertion hardly seems debatable. At this point, I discover that I am at one with the most literal fundamentalists. But then he begins to talk. What is debatable, however, is the question of what the experience of Easter really was. Hence the distance between the Christianity of biblical scholarship and the Christianity of the fundamentalists often opens and begins to widen. Fundamentalists are quite sure of their truth. On Easter, the crucified Jesus, who was laid in the grave as a deceased man on Good Friday, was by the mighty act of God restored to Easter, to life on Easter. He had thus broken the power of death for all people. If the body of Jesus was not physically restored to life, the fundamentalists claim that Easter is fraudulent. There can be no compromise here. Those who waver on this foundational truth of Christianity have, according to this perspective, abandoned the essential core of their faith tradition. Well, my only comment on this would be to borrow the words from an old song and say, it ain't necessarily so. And he goes on and describes that the Easter experience was this tale that began to be told that people could believe in. It wasn't until the 10th century, he said, that this really took hold and people bought into it, and there's no evidence of it before that. And he goes into great lengths to try to debunk everything that the Bible clearly states about the resurrection, but he redefines things. He goes on in his book and he talks about, he said, I am a Christian. I believe that God is real. He'll go on, though, and he'll say, but if you ask me if God is a supernatural being who created the world and did a lot of those miraculous things, I would say, no, there is no way that I believe that. This is a bishop who has published and sold over 1 million copies of this book, who is very popular, very well studied by other people all the time, trying to find this new Christianity in a new world. He does not believe in the God that's talked about, because that God is supernatural. He's not natural. He doesn't believe in something like a literal resurrection, because that's miraculous, and he doesn't believe in the miraculous in any way, because that's not scientific. That would be uncouth to do that. So you're not going to just hear this from people who are unstudied, people who have not thought about it at all. You're going to hear it from people who have thought about it a great deal and have strong convictions about it at times. What do we say to them? How do we respond? We want to talk about how do we respond to these people depending on where they're coming from. First and foremost, I want to reiterate what we've talked about before in here. One of the best ways to respond, and you saw this in the story, is to ask good questions. Ask questions that get them thinking, get them talking, get them explaining what they believe, why they believe it. That is an important thing. Ask questions. And don't just ask questions as a ploy. You need to care about the person. You need to care about what they think, what they believe, where they're coming from. But the more you hear, the more you're going to get a sense of where they are coming from. And as you begin to hear that, you're going to find out that they probably fall into one of a few different camps. We're going to talk, first of all, about people who would respond to you who have some sense of respect for the Bible. They may not believe in miracles, but they have studied the Bible, or they've looked at the Bible, they've grown up under the Bible in some way, but they hold some respect for what the Bible has to say. Well, we'll look at some of the things that the Bible has to say to answer this. What about if they are an atheistic, agnostic, or even a deistic person who does not either believe in God, believes that you can know if there is a God or not, or doesn't believe that even though there's a God, that he does anything supernatural today. How would you respond to those kind of individuals? We'll spend a little bit of time looking at that. What about a person who is just reason, logic oriented? Doesn't make sense. It's not logical to believe in miracles because I don't see any. So don't tell me about this theory or about stuff that took place a long time ago. I don't see anything, and therefore it's not logical or reasonable to me to say, yes, there are miracles. How do we respond to that individual? And then we'll go from there. Okay, so let's look first of all at responding to someone with a Christian background or at least a background that has some respect for the Bible. And most likely, Orange was this kind of a person, as well as the atheist that we'll look at in a few minutes as well. But he probably had some kind of a background that studied the Bible. Here are a few passages. I could have given you hundreds of passages out of the Bible that make reference to the miraculous. But in Genesis 1:1, to begin at the very beginning, in the beginning God created. Would you underline that word, created? He created. Now there are a few different ways we can look at this, but the most common way that this word is used is to bring something into existence out of nothing. There was a time years ago when our children were growing up, we wanted to teach them about pottery, and so we took them on a Saturday to this place where they could make some pottery, and then they could fire it and see what it was like. And they went in there, and they had a wheel, and they had clay, and they would create something. Sometimes we could tell what it was, sometimes we couldn't. But anyway, they would create something. That's not this word. This word doesn't mean to take something and fashion it. It means to bring into existence something out of nothing. That is a miracle. When was the last time you saw someone go into a pottery shop to make clay, to make a vase or to make something out of pottery, and they say, like that, they snap their fingers and a pile of clay appears in front of them? That's bringing something into existence out of nothing. That's not the way we tend to think about it. But that's what this word is. It is this instant bringing something into existence out of nothing. That is a miracle. That is supernatural. That's beyond nature as we know it. It doesn't happen. We don't see that normally. Part of what this is saying, by the way, is that it's answering the question of where did the, if every effect has a cause behind it, well, what was the first cause? And this is the answer to that question. God is claiming in Genesis 1:1 to be the first cause. He was not the result of somebody else bringing him into existence. He was the first cause that brought all other things into existence. Look at Nehemiah chapter 9, verses 10 and 15. This is sort of an interesting place to go for this, but here is Nehemiah reflecting. He's reflecting back on the days of Moses, hundreds of years earlier. But he's talking about the times of Moses. He says, "You, speaking of God, you performed signs and wonders against Pharaoh and all his servants and all the people of his land, for you knew that they dealt insolently against the Israelites. And you got for yourself a name as it is today." Notice some of the things he says you did. "You divided the sea before men, and they went through the midst on dry land. You separated the waters." That's not natural. That's supernatural. That's miraculous. For a body of water just to split open and people to walk through on dry land. Even if you could get the water to separate, it wouldn't be dry land. It would be muck that they were walking through on at that point. It's a miraculous. He says, the persecutors you threw into the depths as a stone into the mighty waters. Verse 12, "Moreover, by a pillar of cloud you led them by day, and by a pillar of fire by night to light the way as they went." You created a cloud. You were in a cloud that led them through the wilderness. And it was a cloud during the day. It was a fire in the sky at night. We don't see that. just happening all the time. Verse 13, you came down also upon Mount Sinai and spoke with them. You were speaking to men as God. Look at verse 15 down near the bottom. You gave them bread from heaven for their hunger and brought water for them out of the rock for their thirst. God, he's just reviewing, and we could go back to the time of Moses and look at one miracle after another, after another, after another. There were all kinds of miracles that we see in the Bible during the days of Moses when he was leading this nation out of Israel. Look at the next passage, New Testament, John 20, verses 30 to 31. He says this, the end of the book, he says, there are also many other signs and miracles. The book of John has a number of miracles, seven pronounced miracles that took place during the book, which Jesus performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. He said, I've given you these seven or so miracles, but there were many more I could have written about in this book. Verse 31, but these are written or recorded in order that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the anointed one, the Son of God, and that through believing upon him, you may have life through his name. It's not just believing in general, but believing who he claimed to be. And we're going to see some of the purposes for miracles later on, but we see one of them evidenced here. John is saying, I've shared these miracles with you, and Jesus performed these miracles so that you might believe that Jesus was who he claimed to be. Not that you would believe in Jesus as the Messiah. We're going to see why that's the case in a minute. But that you would believe Jesus was who he claimed to be. So we're going to see that. It's interesting as we go through passages, as you look through the Bible, miracles do not make people believe. It does not create faith in people at all. All it does is direct our faith. It confirms what we suspect, what we're open to. But it doesn't make us believe something we've already decided we're not going to believe. Think about orange, okay, in the story. What would it take for you to believe that God exists? Well, I want to see a 20-foot shiny green angel stand right here in front of me right now. And if I saw that, I'd believe God exists. And Jay in the story says, okay, let's assume that this angel appears 20 foot tall, shiny green, and he looks at you and says, God is real or the Bible is true. What would you say? Did he say, oh, well, I would believe. Is that what he said? Real life story? No. What he said was, I would say somebody spiked the punch. Why? Because I've already decided he doesn't exist. So if I've already decided that, miracles are not going to sway me in any way whatsoever. But they can authenticate what I'm open to. They can affirm what I'm open to understanding about something. They can do that. And that's what John is saying he hoped these miracles would do for those who were reading his letter at that time. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the last passage there. We're not going to read all of this. But he talks about in verses 3 and 4, for I passed on to you, first of all, what I also had received, that Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed One, died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, and that was according to Isaiah 53 and other passages that talked about that Jesus would come and he would die for our sins. That he was, verse 4, that he was buried, that he arose on the third day as the Scriptures foretold. Again, in Psalm 16 there. Just this whole thing of the resurrection. A couple of miracles are being demonstrated here. First of all, it's miraculous that Isaiah, hundreds of years earlier, could predict all that Jesus was going to go through in Isaiah 53. In fact, it's so graphic that some of the scientific studiers of Scripture that Spung talked about had decided years ago that Isaiah had to have been written during or after the life of Christ. It couldn't have been written before the life of Christ because there were too many pinpoint accurate prophecies about what he would go through. The problem was, then they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. And in there was a complete scroll of Isaiah that was dated back 400 years before Christ, is when the copy of that scroll had been made. So here we have, even if you only looked at that, instead of going back hundreds of years before that to Isaiah, if you only went back 400 years before Christ was born, he made these specific, detailed prophecies about what Christ would go through and that he would be dying to pay for the sins of his people. He would shed his blood. He goes into great detail about that. But he also talked about, we also see in Scripture in Psalm 16, he would raise from the dead. That's something you see every day. We don't. We don't see somebody who's died and been buried for 3 days walk out of the grave. That itself is a miracle as well. The Bible is chock full of the miraculous. It shows us those kind of things. In fact, this is the passage that Spung referred to, where Paul goes on and he says, if Christ did not die and didn't raise from the dead, we of all people are most to be pitied. We have our faith in Christ in vain if he didn't raise, he said. I just want to encourage you to remember, to think about, that the resurrection is the single most important miracle to the Christian faith. There is no greater miracle. Our faith hinges on a miracle. So it's pretty important that we get straight, are miracles possible or not? And in terms of not only what we can spout off, but what do we believe and why about that? Because if we don't believe in miracles, then the foundation of the Christian faith, which was a miracle, the resurrection, is undermined. And we cannot have a Christian faith the way the Bible talks about it. That's responding to someone who has some kind of a biblical background at all. Let's look at the next group of folks that we might interact with, responding to someone who is atheistic. In other words, they would say, I know that God does not exist. Or agnostic, they would say, I don't believe that you can know that God exists one way or the other. Or deistic, and they would say, I believe in God. I believe in the God described in the creator God of the Bible. I don't believe, they would say, a deistic person, that he is involved in this world in any way whatsoever, which would include miracles. That's why when Jefferson, as a deist, a self-acclaimed deist, not my opinion, he declared that himself very clearly and repeatedly, wrote his own Bible, taking all the miracles of the Bible out, because he was a deist. Miracles don't really exist. He just liked the Bible for the stories that they were. He didn't believe the Bible was a supernatural communication from God to mankind. He just believed it was good stories to learn morals from. How would we respond? And really, this is the, I've taken in this section here, Orange in the story asked 5 good questions that we need to be able to think about and respond to. And I've taken those stories out from that true story of Orange and written them down here, and let's just talk about them for a second. The first one of those of the questions is, do miracles make people believe in God? What's the answer to that? No. Miracles do not make people believe in God one way or the other. Remember Orange again. What would it take for you to believe? Shiny green angel. Let's assume there's one there. Nah, somebody spiked the punch. Doesn't make him believe just to see a miracle. That's not the purpose of miracles, though, and we need to understand that. We'll talk more about it, but just let me say a few things there. Miracles authenticate a message or a messenger of God. That's part of the purpose we talked about a few minutes ago. Miracles authenticate a message or the messenger. The prophets, for instance, Moses, the prophets that we'll look at later on. Secondly, miracles externally support what God says is true. When God said, this is what I want you to do, or how you ought to respond, or these things will happen. That is prophetic. He is saying you do it in the future, or if you don't in the future, these are the future things that are going to happen. And God allows those things, that prophecy, those miracles, in the sense of being prophetic about them, to take place so that people would know that what he said is true. There are other things. When a messenger of God comes and says, this is what thus saith the Lord, this is what God says to us as a people, well, how do they know it's from God and not just this guy making up something to tell the people? Well, God would allow miracles to take place through those prophets to authenticate the message, because the supernatural activity, the miracle, was supernatural, not natural. And a natural man would not be able to do those. Third point there, faith is an internal response to what we believe to be true. We need to come to grips with, am I open? Is this person open to the possibility, to reality beyond? Are they stuck? Are they set in their mind about what is true? Because if they are set, if the concrete is quick, if it's already hardened about this issue in their mind, you can talk about miracles and anything else we're going to talk about till you're blue in the face, but it's not going to really help them, because they've already determined, and they will explain away everything because they can't allow it anything to penetrate what they've already decided is true. This is a person that we would call a skeptic. A skeptic isn't a person who is searching for the truth. There is no problem at all. The Bible encourages us to be inquisitive and ask questions and to ask, what about, and is this true, and how can I know, and all those kind of things. But a skeptic only is throwing out blame. A skeptic is only saying, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but. They're not really open to anything that would change the way they've already decided things are. And a skeptic will never be able to penetrate them. The only thing that can begin to penetrate a person who is truly skeptical, who can only think a certain way about things, is to see your life change. And for you to be close enough to them as a friend, for them to see your life change and then be able to interact about that. Because there's going to come a point in time when they want a miracle, when they want to believe in miracles, when something tragic or something hard or something difficult or something unexplainable to them happens in their life. If we're close enough to them and we've built a good reputation, then we might be able to penetrate, but not by just answering with words. The last statement there, miracles do not make us believe what is true, just see what God says is true. Don't forget, in the story about Orange, I cannot tell you how many times I have used that story with people or asked that same kind of question. What would it take for you to believe that God exists, or that miracles are possible, or whatever it may be? What would it take? And by asking that question right up front, you're going to hear in their response where they're really coming from. Are they open to believe anything other than what they've set in their mind already? Are they willing to listen? Are they willing to consider something different than what they've already set their minds on? And you begin to hear some of that. All that to say, don't try to make people believe something they don't believe. It never works. It never does. They will be turned off by you and not want to hear anything else you say. Number two, another question that was asked in one form or another by Orange, why don't we hear about miracles in science and history? And one of those things is, why don't we see them today as well? And I think that's another one of his questions, the next question, but why don't we hear about miracles in science and history apart from the Bible? You have to remember, most individuals who don't believe in God and believe in miracles are going to throw the Bible out. So why don't we hear about miracles in science and history? And we just put there, the natural world is observed, measured, and recorded by science and history. It is usually assumed that the natural world is all that exists. There is this sense of, in our world today, that what we can see, hear, touch, smell, and that sort of thing, the physical things, that's all there is. Now, there is no evidence to support that. We assume that. That is a given right up front, that this is all that there is. And we call all that there is that we can see with and deal with our senses, we call that natural. We call that nature. So we have to understand that definition right up front. I find myself often when people tell me, ask a question like this, why don't we see miracles in science and history? Well, what do you mean by a miracle? What do you mean by a miracle? What are you talking about when you talk about that? That's important information to get. You might write that down. Ask that question. What do you mean by a miracle? That's helpful. Miracles, by their definition, are supernatural and not natural. They're beyond this nature that we see and observe around us. When miracles are observed by science or history, they are put into one of two categories. First of all, they're to be understood as part of nature someday. We don't understand that right now, but someday we will understand that. Now, there is some truth to that. There is some validity to that. There are things that we did not understand 200 years ago that we understand today that explain a lot of things. Right? I mean, you just think back. Our first president had an illness, and one of the most common ways of dealing with that was called bloodletting. They'd open up a vein and take blood out. Well, you do that enough, and things don't work out too well. Okay? And our first president experienced that not working out too well. But that wasn't that long. It was 250 years ago. That was a common way of dealing with something when we didn't know what else to do. We let out blood and assumed that we were letting out all the bad stuff and they'd get better. Now, we've learned a few things. We've learned about germs since then. We didn't know that before. We've learned about how those germs can be in the form of bacterial or viral. We've learned a lot of different things since then and how to treat them. So we could say, well, you know, we're learning things, so we could assume that because we've learned things we didn't know before, there are still a lot of things that we will learn in the future that we don't know right now. And I think that's true. But the big assumption is that everything will be explained by nature as we know it right now if we just wait long enough. Okay? If we just wait long enough, we will discover a natural answer to everything that might be considered supernatural to us right now. So what might that be? To be understood as part of nature someday, given enough time. Why? Because there is no such thing as supernatural to this person. A second response that could be another category when miracles are observed by science and history, this can't be true. It's either we don't understand, but we will someday, or it can't be true. Somebody spike the punch. Okay? It can't be true. Or we'll understand it someday. That's usually a response that we get. So this is a question, why don't we see and hear about miracles in science and history? I just want to read to you from a book called God and the Astronomers by Robert Jastrow, and he makes a statement right up front in the first few pages about himself. He says, it should be understood from the start that I am an agnostic in religious matters. However, I'm fascinated by some strange developments going on in astronomy, partly because of the religious implications and partly because of the peculiar reactions of my colleagues. And he goes on and explains that astronomy has gone back to the point of realizing that this world came into existence instantaneously. They call it the Big Bang, and he makes fun of that name, even though he says that's what the science shows us, is that if you go back far enough, there's evidence in our universe, and I think that there is, that this world boomed into existence, and they call it out of infinite density, or he talks about it's out of nothing. Now, you may say, who's Robert Jastrow? Oh, he's just the guy that founded NASA and a few things like that. Sort of a fairly well-known and established guy, you might say, in the area of astronomy. And he's making fun of this. Listen to what he says near the very end of the book. He makes some comments about the fact that we realize that the world did not just gradually come into being as we have thought in the past, as science has thought in the past. Here are some comments of people to the idea, the scientific idea, that this world came into existence out of nothing. One scientist says, the notion of a beginning is repugnant to me. Another one says, it leaves me cold. Another one says, I read about it, I understand the science, I would like to reject it. Another one says, it is such a strange conclusion. It cannot really be true. You see some of the things we're talking about here. Then he goes on, he says, I think part of the answer is that scientists cannot bear the thought of a natural phenomenon which cannot be explained, which can't be put off into the future and say, one of these days we'll understand it. Even with unlimited time and money, there is a kind of religion in science. It is a religion of a person who believes there is order and harmony in the universe. Every event can be explained in a rational way as the product of some previous event. Every effect must have its cause. There is no first cause, Einstein wrote. He says, quote, the scientist is possessed by the sense of universal causation. This religious faith of the scientist is violated by the discovery that the world had a beginning under conditions in which the known laws of physics are not valid, and as a product of forces or circumstances we cannot discover. The last paragraph he has starts this way. Consider the enormity of the problem. Science has proven that the universe exploded into being at a certain moment in time, out of nothing. It asks, what cause produced this effect? Who or what put the matter or energy into the universe that exploded? Was the universe created out of nothing, or was it gathered together out of pre-existing material? And science cannot answer these questions because, according to the astronomers, everything that would have given them clues would have been destroyed in the explosion. And then he says, now, we would like to pursue the inquiry further back in time, but the barrier to further progress seems insurmountable. It is not a matter of another year, another decade of work, another measurement, another theory. It's not out there in the future somewhere. At this moment, it seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation. How did it all begin? See, evolution doesn't answer that question, and he knows that. Evolution assumes there was something there to evolve. Well, where did the something come from to begin with? For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountain of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. That's from Dr. Robert Jastrow, a scientist, who's saying, you know, we're either going to say it's not true. I see the science. I see what it leads us to. I don't like it, so it's not true. Or one of these days we'll understand. And he's saying, no, it is true. This world banged into existence or came into existence out of nothing. Isn't that what Genesis 1:1 says in essence? In its own way, in the beginning, God created. He brought into existence this universe, the heavens and the earth, this universe, out of nothing. He says, it's true. And we will never be able to find a natural explanation, no matter how much time we have. Okay? I always keep a copy of Robert Jastrow around. You may think that I'm not, I don't even think it's in print anymore, but you can always get it used book or something. But it's a great little resource or something like that for a person who is coming at things from a science point of view, wanting to know, well, show me in science how this can be true. He has an interesting story in there, by the way, about Albert Einstein. He has a lot in there about Albert Einstein. And how Albert, when he produced his theory of relativity, it was over a long period of time, several years, in a quarterly journal that came out. And every quarter he would have another segment of his book until it was finally all finished. When he got to the very end, the next quarter that the journal came out, there was an article in there, a letter to the editor from a Russian physicist. And just applauds Dr. Einstein for his theory of relativity. And he says, but I'm very concerned about one thing. He said, it seems as if Dr. Einstein made a boyhood error in mathematics. That at the very end, he multiplied 1 times 0 and got 1. And anybody knows that 1 times 0 is 0, not 1. The next quarter, Dr. Einstein, he records all this in here with the exact words from it and everything. The next quarter, Dr. Einstein responded, and he said, you are right. I did put that 0 times 1 is 1. And I did so because I did not like the implications of the conclusion. And the implications of the conclusion were that all of matter came from 0. Nothing. And I don't like that implication. So I'm going to change the mathematics so it makes the science look like what I want it to look like, he said. Okay, number 3 on the next page. Should we expect to see miracles in this modern world? You know, that's an interesting thing, because even if you look at what the Bible has to say, most of human history, we have not seen these miracles like we're talking about them. Even in the Bible, it only records 4 major periods in history where we see these periods of miraculous taking place. See it all the way through to some extent, but off and on, but these major examples that we often use. The first one was Moses. Looking at Moses, there were a lot of miraculous things that happened in the life of Moses as he was leading the nation out and as they were wandering through the wilderness. In fact, so much so that Rahab, the harlot, when they go into Jericho, the 2 spies go into Jericho. We see this early on in the book of Joshua in the Bible. She said, I've heard about you. I've heard about your God, the God who parted the water and you walked through on dry land, the God that did this miraculous thing and this miraculous thing and this miraculous thing. I've heard about your God. And she believed because she was open to believing, but the miracles authenticated God to her in some way. The period of Elijah, and I mention Elijah because he's the first of the great prophets, but the period of the prophets that began with Elijah and went all the way down to about 400 BC. That entire period of time, there were a lot of miraculous things that took place through the prophets trying to warn the nation that they needed to change their ways or there was going to come judgment on them. Well, how do I, there were a lot of prophets, some from God and some that were not. So how do I know that what you're telling me is truly from God? And God would do the miraculous through his prophets to demonstrate these are my messengers, not just any messenger. We see another period of time is Christ coming as the Messiah and the apostles that followed him. It was authenticating something that was promised, that's the Messiah, and something new, the church. Christ came as promised all the way, going all the way back to the book of Genesis chapter 3, we see beginnings of this promise of one who was going to come and deal with sin and death once and for all. And this promised one, Jesus, how do we know it's him? Well, it was, look at the miracles. In fact, you have a handout in your notebook, 35 miracles, all the places they're located in your Bible. We're not going to look at that, but there it's in there for you. All 35 of the recorded miracles of Jesus that he did that were first-class, predominant miracles, supernatural events that happened by Jesus and everything. And then the apostles. The apostles were starting something new. Think about this for just a second. The apostles, where were they left to begin this new thing called the church? They were left in the headquarters of Judaism. Jerusalem. He said, I want you to begin my church. Well, how would they know that these apostles were representing God and they were starting something new that God was starting through them and not just doing their own thing? That they weren't just crackpots trying to start something or be rebels like a lot of other people were. How would they know? And the Lord allowed miracles to be performed through the apostles to authenticate, these are my men and their message is my message. I want you to know that. That's a third period. And another period that we see described in the Bible of miraculous events is going to be yet future. It's when the second coming comes, when Jesus comes again. In fact, if you look at Joel chapter 2 and into chapter 3, we covered this, I think, last year in here. We looked at it just briefly. But Joel talks about the sun is going to turn into blood, and the moon, the sun is going to be darkened. The moon is going to turn into blood, that every Jewish man, woman, and child will repent and turn to Jesus as their Savior and will do miraculous things throughout the world. Every one of them will do that. Pretty miraculous stuff. He's talking about just not, he talks about there are going to be miracles in the heavens and on the earth, above us and in a, around us, all around us, he says, during that period of time. There is not anything in the Bible that talks about there are going to be lots of miraculous things that happen during this period of time, during the period of the church. In fact, if we look back historically at the Bible, we don't see but a few periods when that was done. And for the church, that seems to have been done predominantly during the beginning of the church to authenticate its beginning and its birth in the world. But that doesn't mean that miracles don't happen today and can't happen today. They do happen today. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. Number four, is life full of miracles that we just don't see? There are three ways that we can use the word miracle. So this is a way to think about this. If you read some of the literature in the notebook, you would have read some of this as well, at least a part of this. But I'm calling them three different kinds of miracles, or they're sometimes called classes of miracle, but it's not talking about the degree of the miracle, it's just talking about different kinds of miracles. First one is called a first-class miracle, something that never happens in nature. For instance, we see about Jesus' life, walking on the water. You know, I've never seen anyone, I don't have any historical records of anyone ever walking on water, just taking off and walking on water, other than Jesus, who claimed to be God, which he has a different nature than us. But that's sort of a first class. It's something that doesn't happen in nature, because no matter how little we are, how tiny we are as a person, we are always going to weigh too much for the surface tension of water to hold us up, and we're going to go down. We're not going to be able to walk. Now, I had one guy come up to me and say, yeah, but there are some water skiers that if they get going fast enough, they can water ski on their feet, and yeah, but come on. You know what I'm talking about. That would be a skeptic raising that objection, okay? Raising someone from the dead after they've been embalmed for 4 days. That doesn't happen. Somebody doesn't just walk out of a grave after they've been embalmed and been in the grave for 4 days. All the biblical prophecies that came 100% true, we could look at. That just doesn't happen. I don't have the ability, I don't know anyone who truly has the ability to look into the future and say, this is what's going to happen and this is how it's going to happen. But we see that in the Bible repeated. Those are the kind of miracles that I say never happen in our nature. Those are something that are always supernatural. Then there's another kind of miracle. Number two there, something that rarely happens in nature. Some call this a second class miracle. Again, I don't like the terminology, but that's what is common. And just so that you know from the reading where I'm going here. But this is just something that rarely happens in nature. This is something that happens that usually never happens, but it's possible to explain how it did happen, or it happens very rarely. I'll give you an example. Our son, Eric, when he drowned, when he went under the water, he was under the water for at least 15 minutes. And then when Judy was able to get him out of the water and begin to work on him, it was several more minutes before he ever took a breath. And he came alive. He started coughing. He coughed up the water. He started breathing. We got him to the doctor. He almost died at the hospital, but he lived. The doctor said, this is very unusual. How long was he under the water? It was at least 15 minutes. Well, it was cold water, and I know that we can explain it that way, but the doctor said, I've never seen this happen before. I've never seen anyone under the water that long who came back and was okay. So then the question became, is he going to be okay? Or is he not going to be able to think and use his brain and that sort of thing in the future? But, you know, he's a 30-something young man now with his own wife and 3 children and has a very responsible job and does very well. And I've known doctors who were back then who would say, just never seen that happen before. Now, we can say, well, it was a cold water drowning. We can say a lot of those kind of things. But if you ask Judy and me, we're going to tell you it was a miracle. It was something that God supernaturally did, we believe, even though it can be explained if you stretch it or say, well, it's unusual, but even though you can do all that, to us, it felt like a miracle as well. And then there's a third kind that some would strongly disagree with me on. And I put something that reminds us of our wonderful God. You say, that's a miracle? Well, think about it this way. This world that we live in, we call it natural. How did it get here? Did you make it happen? Did you? Anybody there when it happened? Anybody be able to explain it scientifically using the laws of science and nature as we know them, that it can explain how this universe came into existence? The true answer is no. We really can't. Apart from supernatural, that's what Robert Jastrow was saying as a scientist. Science can't explain it. It's beyond nature. This whole thing that we call nature or natural, the natural world, is a supernatural product of God. I did nothing to earn to be born. I did nothing to deserve to be born. And yet I was. I can't explain it. That is beyond my nature to be able to make myself be born and to live and to keep living. There is something that sustains this nature and keeps it, as we call it nature, and keeps it going. The book of Hebrews talks about that, in fact. That is God who is the one who sustains the very thing we call nature and makes it possible to keep functioning and running. So there is a sense in which this natural world is only called natural because we've become familiar with it, because it's common to us. It's what we're used to. But in another sense, this whole existence that we have is supernatural by its own nature. So those are the three things. The things that never happen in nature, things that rarely happen in nature, and something that reminds us of our wonderful God. I look at yesterday we were up in the mountains a little bit, showing the kids and grandkids some snow and letting them play in the snow a little bit up in the mountains. And none of them live right by the mountains. They don't get to go up into it very often. And every time we would make a turn up the mountains and you could see the vistas, you would hear the grandkids go, Now to us who live in this area, we get to see that quite often. We don't have that, but to them, that was awesome. It reminded them of something that isn't part of their nature, part of what they're used to in any way. Number five, how can supernatural things happen in a natural world, Orange asked. How can supernatural things happen in a natural world? Favorite story. You've got to remember this story. You will use this story a lot if you ever have conversations about miracles. Story goes like this. You're going to have to give me some latitude in this story because there's a flower named Daisy. There's a dog named Sam. There is an owner named Joe, and there's a stranger, and they all talk to each other. Okay? The flower, the dog. Some of you may have heard this story before. It's one of my favorites. But the question is, how can supernatural things happen in a natural world? We need to understand, well, what do you mean by miracle? But what do we need to ask, what do you mean by natural? And what do you mean by supernatural? Here's how the story goes. Daisy, the flower, and Sam, the dog, are sitting out. It's a late January morning, and it's been a little cool, but they have a warm spell that day. And things warm up, and they're out there, and the sun is shining, and Daisy says, man, it's getting hot out here. Sure wish I could get up and go over under that tree. Sam's laying there. He says, hey, Daisy, that's a great idea. He gets up, walks over underneath the tree, flops down. He says, Daisy, this is really nice. Thanks for the thought. Daisy wiggles and does everything she can, but she's never been able to get those roots to come up and move across the ground. And she looks at Sam and says, I hate you. You can do that. And then she said in the next breath, that's a miracle. How do you do that? About that time, Sam hears a whistle from Joe inside the house, and he runs up. He knows that's his cue to come in, and he goes through the back door, and Joe, the owner, says, hey, there's a cold front coming in tonight. It's supposed to get really cold in the morning. It's going to be great duck hunting early in the morning. Sam, we're going to go duck hunting. And so they get up. He tells him about that, and Sam's wondering, so how does he know a cold front's coming in? And so he asks, how do you know a cold front's coming in tomorrow, Joe? And Joe says, well, here. And he picks up his tablet computer, and he flips to the weather, and he looks at it, and he says, yeah, cold front's coming in tonight, probably about 9 or 10 o'clock. And it ought to be good and cold in the morning and blustery, just great duck hunting weather. A little bit of rain, snow, it's going to be great. Sam just shakes his head and he goes over and he sniffs at that little device and licks it a little bit, chews on the corner and says, how does he do that? He looks at that little thing and he can tell what the weather's going to be like tomorrow. I don't get it. That's a miracle. The next morning they get up and it really is. It's cold and blustery and spitting rain and snow, and they go duck hunting, and a flock of geese fly over, and Joe rears back. He takes a shot. A duck falls down about 100 feet out in that water, and it has been cold. They're up at a little elevation, and it's been cold up there. It's just sort of icy water. And he says, okay, Sam, go get that duck. And Sam says, you got to be crazy. It's cold out there. This is first thing in the morning. We're going to be out here another 2 hours at least. You're asking me to go out there and get that duck right now? I'll freeze the rest of the day and everything. And they're having this argument, and a stranger walks up. He says, what's the problem? And Joe says, oh, Sam won't go get that duck. Sam says, I'm not going to go get that duck. The stranger says, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. The stranger just walks out and walks across the water about 100 yards, 100 feet, picks up the duck, walks back across the water, and they both have their mouths open, and he hands them the duck, and he says, there. He says, how do you do that? Oh, it's no problem. I do it all the time. He walks away. And Joe just says, that was a miracle. I hope you begin to get the point of the story, but let me make it clear. When we talk about miracles, we're talking about things that are supernatural, super nature. But within our creation that we have here right now, we have different levels of nature already. We have botany. We have zoology. We have humanity that all have different natures. Dogs can't think and reason and build computers and read them. Flowers can't walk wherever they want to go to get in the shade. We live in a world that has different natures built in already. So what makes us think we're the highest nature there is as humanity? It's pretty cocky if you ask me. We're assuming right up front that there is no nature higher than mine, even though when I look, there are other natures that I can see that are lesser than me and lesser than them. It's a great story. Ask the question, what do you mean by a miracle? Do you mean supernatural? What do you mean by supernatural? Tell the story. Daisy, Sam, Joe, and the stranger. And all of a sudden, you will see light bulbs starting to come on. I never thought about it that way before. Now then, on the next page, responding to someone who is logic or reason focused. Logically, there are three possible answers to the question, have miracles occurred and can miracles occur? There are three possible answers. Yes, maybe, or no, maybe, and yes. I mean, if we're just honest, we have to say, well, it has to be one of those, either no, or maybe, or yes. We have to give it, that has to be one of the answers. Let's assume letter A there, the answer is no. Miracles have not and cannot occur. We say there under that, if there is a supernatural cause, then there can be. Would you underline that? Can be. supernatural effects. When we say miracles cannot and have not happened, what we are saying right up front is there is nothing that has a greater nature than us. We're saying that right up front when we say miracles cannot and have not occurred. But if there is a supernatural cause behind everything, if there is something with a greater nature than ours, then we have to be willing to admit it's possible that someone with a supernatural nature over us can do supernatural things. It's possible, anyway. Secondly, there, only a person who knows everything can know there is no God cause. Would you underline who knows everything? Another picture, I think you looked at it last week, but the old knowledge circle. You have this big circle, and it includes all the knowledge of the world inside this circle. Everything that is true, every bit of knowledge fits inside this circle. How much do I have? I've got a little pinprick compared to all the knowledge that there is. So for me to say, I know there is not a God, I am saying I know everything there is to know. I've searched it out. And guess what? Inside this circle of everything there is to know, no God. Okay? That's what we're saying. Now, I've had people say, well, Rick, I don't have just a little prick. I've got smaller pricks all over the place. I know a little bit about a lot of different things. Okay, put all your pricks together and how much do you got? Okay? You ain't got a whole lot, okay? There's just not a whole lot there. I've asked people this. I've said to them, just to put it on a different level, have you ever been convinced that something was true or false, only to find out a few years later you were wrong? Well, if any of us are honest, every one of us would have to say, well, sure. There have been things I thought was true or not true. Later on, I got more information and found out that it was true. I said, so if that happened once in your life, are you saying that can never happen again on this subject about God? Isn't it possible, logic, reason, isn't it possible that what you believe about God now, that he doesn't exist, might be mistaken if you had more information? Now, we're talking about logic and reason here. We're trying to help a person who's trying to think through all this stuff and make sense of it in some way, and just to help them think through that. The third point there, since no one knows everything, no one can say there is no God. It is the height of illogic to say, I know that there is no God. Because again, I'm saying I know everything there is to know, and in that knowledge of everything that there is to know, God doesn't exist. That's the epitome of illogical to say that. I can't say that with a straight face and be honest about that. Therefore, there can be a supernatural cause and effect. Would you underline again, can be? This is where Robert Jastrow came to. I have to admit at least the possibility that there is a God. Even though I don't understand it or believe in something called God, I have to, if I look at all the facts that I do know, look at the information that I knew though, just reasonably, logically, I have to admit at least the possibility that there is a God. Therefore, miracles are possible, whether they have occurred or not. Why? Because if it's possible that a supernatural being exists, then it also has to be possible that that supernatural being does supernatural things. Because that would be their nature. Things that we would call supernatural that are just natural to them. And that leads us to the next, the maybe. By the way, when we talk about miracles, we need to be careful about not using what that number 2 and 3 category or kinds of miracles I talked about. We need to stick with the supernatural kind of things that never happen in nature as we see them. Okay? That's where we need to stay, because otherwise they will immediately jump. A logical, reasoned person is going to immediately jump to, but I can think of an exception. Cold water drowning, have you ever heard of it? I can think of an exception. So they'll immediately go there. Think only of things, talk only about miracles that are beyond this nature and cannot be explained, do not happen in nature at all. Letter B, the second response to this question, have miracles occurred and can miracles occur, is miracles are possible, but they have not occurred, or I haven't seen them occur, or I haven't seen any, that sort of thing. And again, it's best not to share examples of second and third class miracles. Focus on Jesus and the miracles of Jesus here, if you're going to do that. Get into that at all. Jesus claimed to be the revelation of God among us. He claimed to be God in the flesh, Emmanuel, God with us. That's what it means. He claimed to be that. Now that raises a question, doesn't it? Well, how do I know Jesus is who he claimed to be? We're going to get to that in a few weeks. And that may be a rabbit trail that you have to deal with. You can come back again and say, the New Testament records at least 35 first-class miracles by Jesus. That raises a question. Well, how do I know the Bible is true? How do I know it's accurate? Do I know that those things that it records really did happen? We're going to get to that in a couple of weeks when we talk about, is the Bible reliable? But what we're doing is moving a person, helping a person move that's willing to, from an illogical position to say, I know that God does not exist, because they can't know everything and it's possible that God exists outside of their knowledge and everything. So we try to move them from that totally illogical position to at least maybe. And I can use a couple of things. I could use other things as well, but I try to focus on Jesus because it keeps bringing me back to him. And ultimately, that's where I've got to come to. Ultimately, we've got to get there because they're going to have to deal with who Jesus is eventually anyway. So I talk about the fact that who he claimed to be. Well, we'll talk about how to respond to the questions they may have about that. We can talk about what the Bible said about him, the miracles. Well, we'll talk about that if they have objections to the Bible's accuracy. In a couple weeks, we'll look at that. And I just put there at the bottom, the greatest miracle and foundation of Christianity is the resurrection that the Bible talks about as well in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 that we looked at earlier. And I mention here why I believe the miracles of Jesus happened. You may think I am handout crazy, but I have to tell you, you're going to run across people with different backgrounds, different questions that you're not prepared just like that to answer all of their questions. I remember a guy, Brett, that I was meeting with in my home. He had just showed up, he and his wife, late one night at our front door. They were having marriage problems. They were neighbors two doors down. I began to talk with Brett and Laura, and we just had a good conversation, and it became clear. I just asked him, I said, I can't talk to you about how to deal with your problems without bringing God into the equation, because I think he is the one who helps us deal with these kind of things that we don't seem to be able to deal with. And he said, I don't know if I believe in God. I said, would you like to get together and talk about it? And he said, okay, I would like that. So we set up and we started meeting, I think it was Wednesday mornings at 6 o'clock in my kitchen. We would get together and we would talk for several weeks. Wednesdays, we would get together and we would talk about things. And we finally got to the issue of the Bible in this particular case. And he says, well, I just don't believe that. I just think that's a bunch of myths and stories. And he said, I think there's some good things that you can get out of it, just like any book. But he says, I don't believe it's what it claims to be and what people say about it. And I said, really? our time was about up, and I said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to drop off a little article for you to read. Would you be willing to read it before we get together next week? He said, sure. And he was a studious guy. He was not a skeptic. He was really open. He was really searching. And so I dropped it off at his house the next day. It was one of the articles that you're going to get when we get to How Do You Know the Bible is Reliable? I just dropped it off at his house. He was a deep thinker as compared to some that I had spent time with as well. But he had a lot of very specific questions. And there were a lot of very specific answers in this article. And I dropped it off at his house. The next week we got together and he came in and he said, I can't believe it. That was the best thing I've ever read. And he got mad. He says, why has no one ever shared this with me before? Why have I never heard any of this before? He was pounding on my table. He was mad. He was excited all at the same time. Because of one article, a well-chosen article, put in his hand, let him read it, we talk about it. From that time on, my time with Brett was different. And we spent a couple weeks working through that article, talking about it together, but it was like he was a different man. Brett did not receive Christ during our Wednesday mornings together, but a month later, he came. We were talking, and he said, I just want you to know, last night, I received Christ by my bed. He said, you told me how, I knew what to do, and I was ready last night. So a month later, he received Christ. But the thing that was holding him up was one thing, the reliability of the Bible. And for many folks that you're going to spend time with, and they're going to have questions, there's usually one thing that's going to hang them up the most. And if you have something in your hand, I'm not just trying to inundate you with lots of things to read. I'm saying these are things, acquaint yourself with them at least, because you might find them useful someday like I have. In fact, most of the articles that you have in your notebook, I've used with people at different times and found them effective. I could have given you a lot of other things, but I've given you these. By the way, there are four primary questions. When I talk about most people are going to get hung up on the existence of God, are miracles possible, is the Bible reliable, and how do I know Jesus is who he claimed to be? Those four questions, almost every other question we're going to deal with this semester comes back to or is related to one of those four questions. Those are the four big ones that it seems like most people get hung up on. And if we have something to put in their hand, if we can begin to help them through, that would be helpful to them. On the next page, the response may be not only no, or maybe it can be yes. Miracles can and have occurred. And again, to describe the purpose of miracles, the purpose of miracles is to authenticate. The Geisler handout, a biblical description of miracles, is one that I would encourage you, I think we encouraged you last week to read it for this week, but become familiar with that. He will have things in there that people have never thought about before, and I found it useful. So, responding to someone who has more questions, and what I've done here is just put some other information, defining a biblical miracle in some form, and I just put from three different perspectives. From a human perspective, a miracle is an unusual event that communicates an unnatural event that communicates a supernatural message by means of a supernatural power. That's what a miracle is in the Bible to us as human beings. What is a miracle to God? It's a natural act of God. That's just who he is. God doesn't jack himself up so he can walk across water. God just walks across water. He's not limited by time or space or physical thing. He's not limited. He lives in a totally different realm and has a totally different nature than us. So what we call a miracle is God's nature. It's what's natural to him. And from Satan's perspective, it's a natural act of Satan. Can Satan do what we call miracles? Yes, because for the time being, for a temporary period of time, Satan as an angelic being has a higher nature than we do, but that is short-lived. There's going to come a point in time when that is no longer true, when we will have a greater nature than him, the Bible tells us. But for right now, he does that. He has a higher nature than ours. He does not have a nature equal with God's, not capable of doing those things. His nature is still under the control of God, and God, he can only do what God allows him to do. The purposes of biblical miracles are put there to help humanity, who is in a time-space vacuum, to more clearly see and respond to a supernatural God as he really is. Think again for just a second about what we talked about a minute ago. We live in this world and we've become so accustomed to it. So it becomes so common that we call it natural. Even though we can't explain most of the things, how they happen, the way they happen in this world, we call this natural. Why? Because we're used to it. And every once in a while, historically and in present time, in one kind of miracle, God intervenes and just shows us. You really understand it all? You think that's all there is and just interjects certain things? He does that in a lot of different ways. Number two, purposes of biblical miracles is to confirm that certain people and messages are from God and not man. We've talked about that. And number three, to provide astounding evidence for the existence of an astounding supernatural God and an undeniable reason to trust in him. And there you have another passage of Scripture. Other resources to consider there. I just mentioned a few. C.S. Lewis, his book Miracles is a classic. Ken Bo and Larry Moody, the book that we're using in here for those who've been able to get it, I'm glad you asked. Norm Geisler, Miracles and Modern Thought. It is out of print, but if you ever can get a hold of it, it is very good, very thoughtful. And then we come to the rest of the story. What happened to Orange and Jay? Well, true story, we'll call him Jay for the sake of this story, but Jay had this conversation with Orange at the very end of a meeting they were having. It was 4 weeks long. This was the third night, and their conversation took place after the meeting had finished, talking about life and God issues. And they were just around the punch bowl, and a bunch of other people started coming in, hearing this conversation and engaging, and before long, Orange just leaves. And some of you could say, well, that's a downer. That's not exciting. But you see, it's not a failure. Because Jay in this story took Orange from saying, I know there is no God, and I know therefore that miracles can't happen, to saying, maybe. You've made me think. And that is very effective. We think that we're the only ones involved when the reality is we're just instruments in God's hands. And God is doing a lot of things in people's lives. God had been working in Jay's life to get him to the meeting through people apart from Jay altogether. Jay had never met him before. Came to this meeting. Never met him again. Paul talks about it this way. He says, I have planted, others have watered, and some have harvested. But God is the one in charge of the whole thing. So it is very helpful just to help a person think, just to ask them some questions they can't answer, that they've never thought about before, to share a story with them like Daisy, a dumb story. Nobody gets offended. Everybody laughs at Daisy and Sam and Joe and the stranger until you get to the very end and it's like, oh, I never thought about that before. Never saw it that way before. the circle of knowledge and how much knowledge do you have, and just little story, little illustrations like that that you can draw on a napkin or that you can do. I'll tell the story of Daisy and Sam and Joe and the stranger, and I'll just draw circles, and I'll draw a circle, and I'll talk about Daisy, and then I'll draw a circle outside of that one, talk about Sam, and a circle outside of that one, and talk about Joe. And then when I'm telling a little about the stranger, I draw a circle outside of that and say, every one of those have a different nature. We just happen to call that last one super nature, supernatural, beyond our nature, but it's within his nature because he's beyond us. Be able to tell some stories like that, and it get people thinking. You're not going to be able. I didn't lead Brett to the Lord. I spent weeks with him on Wednesday mornings at 6 o'clock in my kitchen. Weeks and weeks. Probably 3 months we got together. We had conversations outside of that, but it wasn't with me. It was later on by his bed at night, reading his Bible that he now believed in, that he came face to face with Jesus and received him. God just used me to water something he had been working on all along, but the harvest came later. And all of those are things that God calls us to do, to be a part of, to do what we can when we can, but not to feel like I've got to force this person to do something, make them do something against their will. I've got to close the deal. That's not what we're talking about in here. We're talking about caring about people enough to ask them questions, make them think, respond to them, get them information that we can to help them when it comes to this. This is one of the four biggies. Are miracles possible? If there is a supernatural God, then it's possible for supernatural things to take place, because that would be natural to that God. His nature to do those things. And a lot of the whys we don't and why this happened, we've talked about in here, and you can just walk through that. But a lot, again, comes back to, well, what do you mean by a miracle? And just to start there, has this been an issue for you in the past? I sense that this is a big issue to you. Is it? Just to ask them, give them the opportunity to talk. I led these kind of discussions that is talked about in here for a number of years, and it was very interesting to see how many people would come and have these discussions. I remember one guy in particular said, Rick, I've never been able to talk about issues like this except for one other time in my life. He said, I can't go to church and raise my hand and say, hey, wait a minute, I'm not really sure God exists. Or wait a minute, I'm not really sure that Bible you're reading from is true. He said, where do I go to deal with those kind of things? He said, I don't know anybody. You're the first person who's ever talked to me about these things, and I feel like I can talk about it. He says, the only other place I've ever been able to do it is at a bar after 3 or 4 drinks. He says, then I have enough courage to talk about them even though nobody else wants to. And he says, but he just was exploding. He says, I've got these questions. I just want to talk about it. Well, ask them questions. Let them talk about it and see where it leads. It's such an important thing. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much that you are a God who is knowable. You've told us that you want us to not only know about you, but to have an intimate relationship with you, to be closer to us than anything that we can imagine. God, thank you for that. God, there are so many friends and family members around us who are searching for answers, and they don't even know the questions sometimes that they're wrestling with, but they're just wrestling inside. Help us to be people who can come alongside, who can be used by you to just say, how you doing? What do you mean by that? Got something that might help you. God, make us useful instruments in your hands, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen. You have some questions around your table. I want to encourage you. there's a purpose for these questions, particularly in this semester, and that is one of the biggest problems we have as a church of Jesus Christ is that we don't know how to talk to other people about these things. So we're trying to give you an opportunity to do that right here, to get used to it a little bit in a friendly atmosphere, just to talk about some of these things. It might be a good first step for some of you to move on from here. See you next week.